I did not prepare a 4th of July special this year. Instead, I thought it would be appropriate to reflect back on 1776 and to actually read the Declaration of Independence and to see what issues faced our forefathers as they sought freedom from the crown of England. It was actually signed on July the 4th of 1776. It was agreed upon 2 days earlier on the 2nd. This is the text that primarily Thomas Jefferson has been given credit for, although there were others who contributed to its formation. Here's the text that was ultimately signed and therefore declared our independence. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them. A decent respect, therefore, to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when the long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained, and when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions of the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time after such disillusions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers incapable of annihilation have returned to the people at large for their exercise. The state remaining, in meantime, exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convolutions within. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for the purpose of obstructing the laws of naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing to assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept among us, in times of peace, standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of the superior to civil power. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation, for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments, for suspending our own legislatures and declaring them invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is, at this time, transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to welcome the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands. He has excited domestic insurrections among us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In every stage of these operations, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our immigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity. We have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends. We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America and General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these united colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Signed by order and in behalf of the Congress, New Hampshire, Josiah Bartlett, William Whipple, Matthew Thornton. Massachusetts Bay, John Hancock, Samuel Adams, John Adams, Robert Trent Payne, Eldridge Gerry. Rhode Island, Stephen Hopkins, William Ellery. Connecticut, Roger Sherman, Samuel Huntington, William Williams, Oliver Walcott. New York, William Floyd, Philip Livingston, Francis Lewis, Lewis Morris. New Jersey, Richard Stockton, John Witherspoon, Francis Hopkinson, John Hart, Abraham Clark. Pennsylvania, Robert Morris, Benjamin Rush, Benjamin Franklin, John Morton, George Clymer, James Smith, George Taylor, James Wilson, George Ross. Delaware, Caesar Rodney, George Reed, Thomas McKean. Maryland, Samuel Chase, William Paca, Thomas Stone, Charles Carroll of Carrollton. Virginia, George Wythe, Richard Henry Lee, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Harrison, Thomas Nelson Jr., Francis Lightfoot Lee, Carter Braxton. North Carolina, William Hooper, Joseph Hughes, John Penn. South Carolina, Edward Rutledge, Thomas Hayward Jr., Thomas Lynch Jr., Arthur Middleton. Georgia, Button Gwinnett, Lyman Hall, George Walton. And that started it all. And we celebrated that declaration yesterday officially, but it has been a celebrating weekend, as we have been able to determine from the noises in our neighborhood. But I think it's nice that some of them decided to clean up the mess, some did not, which to me doesn't bode well for their true appreciation of what the day was all about. Others, of course, cooperated nicely. It is a weekend of celebration, quite obviously. We have been watching piecemeal celebration and the concert that goes on at Washington that is on PBS. I just do not understand the music today. And I don't understand the people that are listening to it. But that's just me. I understand this. But there is a breakdown in public decency when people gather together, apparently, in this day and age. The celebration, though, is necessary. The celebration is important because it gives us the opportunity to reflect back on why we are here as a nation. And the thing that really needs to be understood is what I just read to you. This was the fuse that lit the flame that caused things to commence and to do so in the acquisition of our freedom from England. England has this procedure where they, through consanguinity, have a series of kings or queens. I think Elizabeth II is going to outlive them all. I saw on TV the other day she was having some kind of a celebration somewhere, and she was there with her husband, Prince Philip. And Prince Philip is about 6 or 8 feet from the grave, and she looks strong as ever. And she looks completely healthy, and she may last another 10 years. I think she may outlive that son of hers. I forget his name. But he's the next in line to the throne. And it's probably a good thing if he would just go on let that whole thing die. But I think that this Harry, I think, would be a good king. I think Harry seems to be willing to step forward and take charge of things. The other fellows are busy spawning. See if you can get another king in the line. So this Munchkin, about a year old, is of course way past when I'll see it, unless they start murdering each other again. That's been known to happen. So nevertheless, we're celebrating our freedom, celebrating the creation of our independent states, as it's called. I thought that was interesting phraseology of that day. Free and independent states. That's an interesting term now. So let's talk about what is going to happen in the future. There's going to come a time when client nation America will fade into history, and they'll be writing books about it. Why did it fall? What were the reasons for it? And so on. And time will march on. And some of us will be forced to move somewhere else or stay here and take the business that will be handed out, whatever. But you must remember that you're in the plan of God and you're not wanted here. So it's always comforting to look at it that way. Once you believed in Christ, you became a member of the heavenly polytuma. You became a member of a heavenly community. And you became a member of a system that functions on absolute grace. Nothing else but that. And so you're isolated from whatever the business happens to be on planet Earth. It's varied and it's sundried. But it always is in a downtrend. It has a little spurts of uptrends because people have the thought and they have accumulated in their minds the kinds of principles, ideas, doctrines, and they are functional on those, and it creates a maximum amount of prosperity and freedom in a hostile environment. And so we're always going to be under assault from the dark side. So it's not surprising, and it's certainly not unusual. These are the kinds of things that undulate in the uptrends and downtrends of history, and we have never been immune to that. And what we are studying now has to do with what happens to that kind of person with that kind of mentality that rejected the grace of God and went to the ideas and functions of man. And once this earth is cleared of all believers at the rapture of the church, and these people are going to see if they can bring order to this planet. They will fail miserably, and they will do it in a hurry. They'll have 7 years to figure out how to get it done, and that is not going to happen. In fact, it becomes so out of whack that Jesus Christ finally says, enough. And he comes back, and he begins the process of clearing the decks, kicking shins, taking names, and getting all organized. And then he will run the show and show people how it's done. Now, you must remember that in the millennial kingdom, you have a perfect environment. And not only Eden displayed and distributed this idea, but also confirmed the doctrine and the principle that the freedom and prosperity a person enjoys has nothing to do with his environment. In the perfect environment of Eden, man fell. And therefore, we have the environment that's left. With this climate change and everything, I mean, point your finger at Adam. And at a point in the future, there will be a return to Edenic perfection, and Jesus Christ will run the show for 1,000 years. But as I've displayed for you in our study, there will be a group of people that will enter the millennial kingdom as Homo sapiens, and they will begin the repopulation of the planet. and their spawn will have a sin nature and they will use it. And over the course of 1,000 years, there will be the accumulation of a large body of people who are alive in a perfect environment who will rebel against God. And there will yet again have to be another intervention. And so perfect environment is not the answer to man's problems. It only entices them to want more and to be in control of it as well. So we are at Acts 2:19, and we're going to study some things with regard to it. I don't know. I had a breakdown in my computer last night, and I think I do have this particular diagram that will help. What we're looking at here, the last few days of the Great Tribulation. This is the latter half of the tribulation as both a dispensation as well as the last 3.5 years of that period. And so with the Great Tribulation, as it's called, we have the increase of violence. This is a struggle for power among four major areas of the Eastern Hemisphere. And this is documented in several Old Testament books that have to do with prophecy and end times. It also has to do with the book of Revelation, which reveals a number of details associated with what will occur once the rapture of the church is completed. This begins actually in chapter 6 of Revelation and runs through most of chapter 19. And we'll see some of these passages in our study. And while we are on this particular subject, we are looking at it in order to get completely organized in our thinking about what the issues are when the church age begins in Acts chapter 2, and why Joel is brought into it, and why Acts chapter 2 is using Joel as an example of what is going on in the streets of Jerusalem, but it's prophetic about what will occur in the dispensation of the tribulation. The second advent, of course, is involved, and then there's a period of time at the end of that for organizational purposes. And, of course, the millennial kingdom kicks it all off in the first two verses of each passage. But you can see on this board here that the Great Tribulation is where we are in this verse. Acts 2, verse 19 and 20 have to do with the latter phases of the tribulation. Now, it reads this way, "I will grant wonders in the sky above and signs on the earth below, blood, fire, and vapor of smoke." So let's review what these three categories are at the end. Blood is used to describe the horrors of warfare, and specifically in this passage, to describe the Lord's miraculous slaughter of these armies advancing on Jerusalem. So we're seeing the end game here. The word fire is emblematic of mass slaughter. When the righteous are under assault from emissaries of the dark side, deliverance will often intervene through divine providence. And finally, of course, we have the last issue here, pillars of smoke that billow from the ruins of all expressions of ecumenical religion. Ecumenism is a concept the Catholic Church adopted from the very beginning. It's not an evil idea to want to branch out and try and absorb other people that will fall under the umbrella of your theology. That's fine. But when the theology is corrupt, when the theology is blasphemous, then that becomes a problem, and the Catholic Church has illustrated that over the course of about 2,000 years. And it gives us a heads up on what will occur in the tribulation when there is no divine viewpoint, but there is a drive to incorporate people into humanistic ideas and concepts, which always turn tyrannical. And so those who are vying for power are going to meet at the Levant, and they're going to fight it out in what is called the Armageddon campaign. And the outfit that probably is favored, if you take bets in that day, you're going to put your money on Europe, because they're the ones that Scripture reveals probably has the most going for them, primarily with the fact that who's running that show is the beast dictator who is indwelt by Lucifer himself, who is the ultimate genius of all created beings. So who is going to have the advantage there? So we'll see that they're the ones that are going to move forward. They have the army that is capable of meeting up with the other three. There will not be a denouement to that because Jesus Christ will come back and he will put a stop to the whole organization of various forms of nuclear activity and all of this. So he is on guard to be ready to intervene at the point that he deems necessary. So the pillars of smoke that billow from the ruins of all expressions of ecumenical religion, they like to burn incense, and therefore they get it in spades here. Now, it is pointed out in by the Apostle John in Revelation 18. In this context, ecumenical religion is symbolic of Rome, and we will do some work on that today. Now, I want to go to Revelation chapter 18, verse 2. This is in the midst of what we've just noted. It's in the midst of this warfare that rages in the Middle East. And the angel having great authority. There are a number of angels that are mentioned in the book of Revelation, and many of them have speaking parts. And when you analyze this from stem to stern, there are a lot of angels that are recognized in the book of Revelation. There are elect angels. We're noting one. And there are, of course, fallen angels known as demons. And these fellows are run by Lucifer. The thing that also needs to be understood about angels that are mentioned in Revelation is that there are categories of angels. Those that have been promoted in the angelic conflict before humanity entered the scene, all the angels apparently, the chief angels were apparently cherubs, and they had the rank of four wings. We have these insignia of rank on our military. They wear them on their clothing or their caps or their hats, as the case might be. And you can tell what rank an individual has by looking at these insignia of rank. These angels are depicted in art as if they had literal wings, and they sprouted out the back of their shoulders. And usually they are decommissioned because usually they have just two wings. And there's no record of any two-winged angels in Scripture. None have been decommissioned except for Lucifer. And he was a cherub. And he was the highest-ranking angel in his day of glory. And if he was a cherub, then he had an insignia of four wings, as cherubs are said to have. Subsequent to that, we will run into seraph-ranked angels, and they have six-wing insignia. And they, therefore, have been promoted in the ancient angelic conflict. Now, there are ways by which angels function in the angelic conflict with respect to the church age. And there are those who are categorized in warfare and communication. So you have the angelic college of heralds. A herald is someone who pronounces information to individuals that need to know. And so we have studied, for example, Gabriel, communicating information to the Holy Family, as it's called, and to others, for example, the shepherds, during the time of our Lord's birth and pregnancy. And so that is a herald angel, and that is Gabriel, and he is seraph rank. The other seraph rank angel is that we're aware of by name is Michael. And so Michael is therefore in charge of the military. They swap assignments on occasion, but that's the general idea. Now, in what we're noting here is a seraph-ranked angel that is the king of arms of the angelic college of heralds. When he appears on the scene, he has some very important things to communicate. And so we do not know his name, but he is called here in this passage, and the angel having great authority. And that great authority makes him, since he's communicating information, he's the highest-ranking seraph in the angelic college of heralds, and he is also noted in verse 1. And he cries out with a mighty voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." And we're going to learn that Rome, as headquarters of ecumenical religion, is what Babylon refers to, Babylon the Great. We will examine this, and you will understand when we're done why Rome is called Babylon. There's a reason for it. She has become, Rome has, or Babylon, a dwelling place of demons. These are fallen angels. They're called demons in passages. As demons, they're made to look ugly. You know, all kinds of gnarly-looking characters and various forms of art depict demons that way. And the angels are made to look sort of what is the word you use when you don't know whether it's a man or a woman? I don't know, there's a word for that. And so you don't really know that these angels, whether they're a guy or a lady, because it's so pretty, you know, and they have wings all poked up. So you think, whoa, what is this? Well, look, we tried to do our best over here with Gabriel on the painting, I think is the official word for that, the painting of the virgin birth. And we've got a six-winged seraph rank Gabriel over there. And he's making announcements and pointing to things that they need to pay attention to. And when you look at that, I told the artist, I said, he has to look like a person who has real serious authority. He has to look masculine. He has to look like a person that's really put together, like he's been to Gold's Gym for the last 15 years. You know, and his wings have to be out there, and they have to be significantly six of them. So he said, I got it. And so we think we've got a good angel over there. And you can tell he's a guy, okay? And he looks like he could take charge, and he could kick shins and take names. That's the kind of guy you need to have there. So there's the angels. But then you look over at the demons. They look like that they are, I don't know, something out of a Steven Spielberg space adventure kind of thing. And they're not. They are in the same manner. They look the same way as these elect angels do. They just have bad attitude. And they're very brilliant. They're very smart. And it's hard to outfox them. And that's why the angelic conflict is such difficult process to grasp as a human being, because you can't get around the fact that these guys are way smarter than we are. And so if you think you can outfox these people, you're just flat wrong. They are brilliant. They have great leadership in Lucifer, and they have also higher ranking angels that are assisting him, like Beelzebub, for example. And there are others. And Apollyon is another that's named. So if they had insignia of rank, we don't know what it would be, but they would be up there. And they are really put together people. So keep that in mind. You are not, no weak sisters here. So what have we got here? A dwelling place for demons. And they're the same kind of characters that we can describe as being elect angels. So these are fallen. And then we have the word prison. The word prison in the Greek is phylake. And that's a good translation for it. I'd like for you to note the footnote here on that. In the New Testament, figuratively, of Babylon as the dwelling place, station, haunt of demons and unclean birds, where they resort to holding their vigils, according to Revelation 18:2. A place where someone is watched, guarded, kept in custody, or a prison. And so they're imprisoned. And the question arises is, how are they imprisoned? How do you imprison these guys? They certainly are of a capability of not being imprisoned. They're angels, for Pete's sakes, although fallen. So we'll have to look at that. And that the word phylake, or prison, becomes very important in another application, which we'll get to in due time. And then we have the phrase, every unclean spirit. That's another term for demons. They're called unclean spirits when they indwell someone. And that's called demon possession. And we have a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. Well, what are unclean birds? That refers to birds identified in the Mosaic Law as such. Hateful denotes vultures that will soon feast on human carrion. And we'll get to that in due time. Now, we will come back to the word phylake later to note an interesting concept it reveals in this verse. Now, back in our passage, celestial phenomena occur which introduce the last two warnings that herald the second advent of Messiah. Again, Acts 2:20, the sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and glorious day of the Lord shall come. Note what happens before the second advent. You have the sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and glorious day of the Lord shall come. So that means we're still in the tribulation. Now, several problems emerge in this verse on how to translate it. In concert with other verses on the same subject, it appears to be taken literally. For example, in Isaiah 13, verses 9 through 10, Ezekiel 32, verses 7 through 8, Joel 2, verses 10 through 11, Amos 5, 18, Zechariah 14, 6, all of which may be compared to Joel 2, 31 and Acts 2, 20. However, the sun cannot be darkened while at the same time the moon in eclipse appears with a reddish hue, a phenomenon referred to as a blood moon. You can't have a solar eclipse and a lunar eclipse at the same time. So that's not what's going on here. I want to read you a little excerpt that I found on the internet. It's called timeanddate.com regarding eclipses. You can predict these. You know that to be the case. You can be warned of it and go outside and look up in the air and see these things. You be careful with a solar eclipse, even if it's a total solar eclipse. The corona around it can blind your eyes over time. So you have to look through a punched hole in a cardboard box. Believe me, it works. I thought they were pulling my leg, but it's true. So listen to this. The puzzle of why the sky looks blue and a totally eclipsed moon turns red is the Earth's atmosphere. The atmosphere is about 300 miles thick and is made up of different gases, water droplets, and dust particles. When sunlight entering the Earth's atmosphere strikes the particles, they get scattered. Colors with longer wavelengths, like red and orange, get refracted back to the surface of the moon and give it a reddish-orange glow. So when we look at Acts chapter 20, chapter 2, verse 20, the sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood. So we got to work on that just a minute. Obviously, this is not a blood moon. A blood moon is when the sun is doing this on a normal eclipse. There's no eclipse going on here. So that has to be observed. A blood moon, a moon that is given its reddish color when the sun, which is darkened in this case, combines with atmospheric pollution to diminish its clarity. Now, a blood moon, where actually there is an eclipse, has this same reddish-orange hue to it. When it occurs. It doesn't always occur that way. The atmosphere dictates this, and the atmosphere is not up to speed with causing these problems, then it's not a blood moon. But there are moon eclipses. You've obviously seen them where the moon looks just as white and gray as it always does. This is not an eclipse. Now imagine the types of ordnance that will be available during the final days of the tribulation. We get a picture of what kind of destruction can go on in the future when these four major armies are advancing upon each other and they're seeking to take a piece of real estate that is, the French call it the Levant. Now, I've looked all over trying to find a map that will depict each of the countries that are presently in the Middle East in what's called the Levant. But if you have an idea of the Mediterranean Sea, and I really think I could do better than that. It's more like this. And so this is the eastern shore over here. I'll put ES, eastern shore. And you've got countries that are located on the coast of this eastern shore, and it includes also Jordan and also Cyprus, which is an island sort of along there. And so you have countries like Syria and Lebanon and Israel, and over here is Jordan, and so on, and down here you have Egypt. And now, listen, this over here This is landmass. This is actually what we call Turkey today. But that is an avenue to Europe. So if you're going to move armies overland, I mean, you can do this in the sea, but you need to also have the capability of moving them on real estate. And so you have armies that are coming in over here. I say that's Europe, but they're going to be called the West, and Russia is the North, and China is the East. That's over here. And then over here in Arabia, I'll just call it Arabia, they're going to be coming in from the South. Now, if you want to have dominance on three continents, if you want to move from one to the other, you've got to go through the Levant. And that's these countries that border the eastern shore of the Med. Now, why are they fighting this war? Well, the beast dictator wants to set up a global government that will worship him. A global government where religion is completely wiped out, and he will be the stud duck. And he, therefore, wants to come in and shut down all that's going on in Israel. He wants to get rid of the Jews to get them out of there so he can set up shop if he can win this battle. Why does he want to win the battle? Because he can move merchandise or armies or other materiel over to Africa by going through the Levant, undeterred. People that are coming in from Arabia have to go through the Levant to get to Europe. People that are coming in from China want to go either way, they've got to go through the Levant. The northern people, if they want to go south, if they want to go to Africa, they got to move through the Levant. So that is an extremely geopolitical situation of real estate. So what is the motivation to have them accumulate in Israel and specifically Jerusalem? The human viewpoint reason is to gain property, important property, in hopes of establishing your global government. The dark side of all of this, the motivation of the beast dictator, is being influenced by Luciferian input. And what Lucifer is up to is getting rid of the Jews. So he's doing two things. He's making an advance that will help him set up a global government if he wins these battles, the Armageddon campaign. And underneath all of this is anti-Semitism, Lucifer's campaign to get rid of the Jew. So if you've ever wondered why are these people going through all of this just to get rid of the Jews? What are the Jews doing here? Well, Lucifer knows what the Jews are doing. If these people survive, then they're going to move into the millennial kingdom and fulfill the Abrahamic, Davidic, and Palestinian covenants. They're going to fulfill those because it takes at least two Jews to get this done. And if I can wipe them out, then the Lord cannot fulfill these and I win the angelic conflict. So that's what Lucifer's motivation is. These guys are after real estate so they can run the show. Okay, where was I? Imagine the types of ordinance that will be available during the final days of the tribulation. So we're in this area right here. A world under the control of Lucifer, who indwells the beast dictator. World leaders under ingrained demonic influence and armies converging on the Levant for the purpose of wiping out the Jewish people. That's the motivation for all of this. The effects of exploding ordnance, the kinds that first and even second world nations presently possess, will cause tremendous darkening effects on the atmosphere of the region. I want to get a blank in here so you're going to be there. This will cause tremendous darkening effects on the atmosphere of the region. So as the Armageddon campaign progresses, huge amounts of ordnance is going to be expended. Now, we know that today a number of nations have nuclear weapons. I said second world country because I don't know what you would call North Korea. It's a dump. But it has nuclear weapons, like dump countries. But they have nuclear weapons, and apparently they're not afraid to use them. And you have Iran, who's on the verge, if we will just simply let them. And we have others. And then they're the superpowers, so-called. There's China, and there's the United States and Russia and so on. Now, that's some very serious ordinance. And as time marches on, scientists will come up with other things. I mean, what we're able to do with computers now, it just goes beyond me. And if you understand this and understand the power of it, then you'll understand what's potentially there as time marches on. So we're going to have, when these battles break out, some very serious things going on. And it is going to create a mess in the atmosphere. This is something that Al Gore has been praying for. He can certainly sell pollution if we can just stand back and watch this thing play out, and he very well may. So let's see. A world under the control of Lucifer and dwells the beast dictator, world leaders under ingrained demonic influence, and armies converging on the Levant for the purpose of wiping out the Jewish people. Now, the effects of exploding ordnance, the kinds that first and second world nations presently possess, will cause tremendous darkening effects on the atmosphere of the region. The sun will not be darkened in other areas of the world, so its rays projecting through the atmosphere will imitate a blood moon, while in the area of Israel, sunlight is diminished by the atmospheric pollution. So it's darkened, it's not blacked out like we have at the second advent. Now, devastation and death will be widespread throughout the Levant. But all these things will occur before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. And so the day of the Lord is a term assigned to the second advent of Christ, which terminates Daniel's 70th heptad. So the 70th heptad is winding down. And the events described in Acts 2, verses 19 through the first part of verse 20, and Joel 2, verse 30, and the first part of verse 31, occur before the great and glorious day of the Lord shall come. Tribulational events, therefore. And this means that the atmospheric events described above are caused by pollution's dramatic effects on the earth's atmosphere. They are not the same as the supernatural events that commence in association with the second advent. We haven't come to the day of the Lord yet. So on the day of the second advent, there will be supernatural darkness for 24 hours over the entire world. No light will penetrate this darkness. And this cover of darkness will bring the amassed armies to a halt and disrupt their attack on Israel. Several passages of Scripture describe this event. Now, I've got several for you. They are all from the Old Testament. They are prophetic of the second advent of Christ. And they give us a lot of information about what will happen at that moment. But all of them mention the concept of what is going on in the atmosphere. So we will begin by an overview of these several verses to kick off our second session. And it's time now for us to pause for tea and crumpets. And we'll be back here at 10 till the hour.